Welcome, Serious Eaters, to a special Thanksgiving call special sauce. Serious Eaters from all over the country have sent us Turkey Day-related questions that they would like us to answer. What we're really trying to do here is take the stress and worry out of Thanksgiving. Here to do the answering and provide the stress reduction are two Serious Eaters who know a thing or two about cooking and baking, Kenji Lopez-Alt, our chief culinary consultant and the best-selling author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, and Stella Parks, our resident pastry wizard and another New York Times best-selling author of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts. Welcome, Kenji and Stella. You guys are thousands of miles away from each other, but through the magic of this studio, we're all together.
Thanks, Ed.
Hey, Ed.
So, like, what's up, Stella? Just got back, Kenji, you know, from vacation. She sent us tons of photos.
Oh, I know. I've seen them.
Stella, tell everyone a little bit about, like, that Airbnb you found, which was just spectacular.
Oh, man. We had a great vacation. My first ever vacation, in fact. But we had a chance to stay in a Hogan in Monument Valley, Arizona. It's a traditional Navajo dwelling. And so it's called a female Hogan, and it's a little bit of a larger size, and it's designed for people to sleep at night. And it was just absolutely beautiful. And the host of our Airbnb is actually on Instagram. Everyone should check out her Instagram. She takes the most beautiful photos of just her life in Monument Valley and everything that's going on there. So it's kind of like an outdoor camping experience a little bit, except that we had a roof over our head and a potbelly stove. But we had otherwise fully outdoors, no running water, no electricity, that kind of thing. It was a really great break. So not that I don't love being connected to you all 24/7.
And Kenji, you just got back from a trip too, right? But this was a shorter, less scenic trip, right?
Well, it was pretty scenic. Yeah, I just took my daughter, Alicia, to visit her two aunts. So my older sister in Colorado, she lives outside of Boulder. And my younger sister, who lives in Bozeman, Montana. It was pretty scenic. I mean, you know, mountains and big sky and snow. It was nice.
And you had running water.
Yes, in both places. Fireplaces, running water. She got to build her first snowman.
And she must have loved that.
She did love. I mean, it was her first, like, real snowfall. She saw snow when she was a tiny, tiny baby, but this was her first time, like, where she was aware of what was going on and could experience it. So that was, yeah, it was really nice.
Did you actually use a carrot for a nose? You know, because we have to bring this to Thanksgiving somehow. So I needed a transition
right
there.
No, we used rocks and berries that she kind of just squished into the face. So it was all, you know, there were these purple berries. And so as she squished them in for the teeth, they kind of bled out all over the face. So it ended up with this kind of like Heath Ledger's Joker. Like
it looked like a snowman in an ICU, like a snowman who just
yeah, like,
up.
You know, like a vampire or the Joker snowman, I'd say. Yeah.
All right, now we have to get to Thanksgiving. We have so many questions we need answered, but we do, you know, there's something that I've been wanting to know, so I'm going to get my question answered, and something we don't talk about a lot, which is this whole notion of gravy, which I buy. I'm a little embarrassed to tell Kenji and Stella, just because it's always seemed like it would be too difficult to do, even though, Kenji, you've written extensively on the site that it's not that hard to do.
To make really perfect anything, you're going to have to work hard, including gravy. But it's very easy to get something that is, you know, 98% perfect in a relatively short amount of time. You know, with gravy, so you know, my method for gravy, I generally spatchcock my turkeys, which I'm sure we'll talk about more in this episode, which means that you end up with the turkey's backbone already out of the bird before you even start roasting it. So you get the neck and the backbone and whatever other giblets it came with. And so that's like basically all you really need to fortify a chicken stock to make it into a really good gravy. So, you know, if you have homemade chicken stock, that's great. Some people keep it in their freezer. Some people make it fresh all the time. If you don't, it doesn't really matter. You can use store-bought chicken stock. Add to that your, you know, brown your turkey necks and turkey backs. brown some vegetables, carrots, onions, and celery, and then fortify that store-bought chicken stock with all those flavors, and just let it simmer on the stovetop for about 45 minutes or so. And you're going to come up with a stock that doesn't taste, you know, it's not like the most perfect stock you'd ever had at the best restaurant in the world, but it tastes really good. And that's going to be the basis for your gravy. You know, from there you can thicken it however much or however little you want, or if you want to add other flavors to it as well, you know, cider or wine or citrus juice, whatever you want to add to it. And then you thicken it, and that's basically it. You know, gravy's not that hard.
What's the difference between gravy and jus?
It's really just a question of thickness. And of course, you know, like all language, there's probably going to be some overlap between how some people use those two words. But a jus is typically a very sort of thin sauce made from generally from the drippings of a roasted meat. So if you take your turkey drippings from the pan, poured them into a cup, defatted them, clarified it a little bit, maybe you could mount it with some butter, season it. That's basically a jus, a turkey jus.
Got it.
Whereas a turkey gravy would be sort of the equivalent, but you're also adding typically, you know, a flour and butter, a roux to thicken it.
Right.
The other thing I like to do with my gravy, which, you know, some people consider cheating and whatever, I don't care, is that we add a little bit of soy sauce to it. And this is actually something that my grandmother did, my mother did. So this is a alt family, a Nakanishi family tradition, actually. You know, a little bit of soy sauce. When I do it, I actually put enough to make it sort of taste a little bit like soy sauce, just because I like that flavor. But even if you don't want that flavor, even just a little splash of it is, I find it gives it a nicer color, and it also sort of really deepens the flavor and brings out some of the other sort of more roasty flavors in the turkey.
So, Stella, what about at your house? What's the gravy situation in Kentucky?
My mother-in-law handles Thanksgiving in its entirety, so I don't lift a finger for Thanksgiving, nor am I fully versed in her inner workings. It's like a very mysterious time, but it's her thing. Thanksgiving is like what she lives for all year, and she knocks it out. She takes care of it, and I just get to kick back, which is actually pretty nice considering, you know, that I do a lot of cooking and baking for work all the time, so it's nice to
That's
coast.
Great. So you don't even have to bring the pie?
I don't bring a dang thing.
That's so great. All right, we have a question from Stephen Aldridge, who wants us to recommend either dry brining the turkey in buttermilk, or perhaps another method for packing some extra flavor into the turkey before dunking it into a vat of hot oil. He says he's done a bit of research online recently, but hasn't found many strong recommendations. He would love any advice that you two have to share.
Sure. So he's talking about deep frying a turkey. When you're deep frying a turkey, you're obviously not, you know, you're not doing the spatchcock, which I would do for the oven. But it doesn't really matter because you're getting sort of even heat from all around. One of the problems you get with deep frying is that it's such a high heat method that it so aggressively cooks the turkey that if you're not careful, and if you don't take some preventative steps, it can end up quite dry. So that is where brining or dry brining would come in. I almost always recommend dry brining over wet brining, just because I find that you end up with better flavor when you do a wet brine, which is where you dunk the turkey in a cooler or a big pot of salt water. You end up kind of diluting that turkey flavor. Some of the juices from the turkey run out into the water. Some of the water goes into the turkey. And so your turkey ends up juicy, but a little bit diluted. So a dry brine where you just salt aggressively and let it sit for a couple days, it has a lot of the same effects. It helps prevent the meat from seizing up too much when it gets hot. So you squeeze out fewer juices. So the turkey ends up juicier. But the flavor that you get in that turkey is more concentrated because you're not watering it down. Whether you're roasting or you're deep frying, I would pretty much always recommend dry brining. With a deep fried turkey, the other thing that I've found works and which a lot of people do is injecting it. I like to make an injection mixture which has both fat and water-based liquid in it. So a nice chicken or turkey stock, maybe fortified with some herbs like rosemary and thyme. And then to that I mix in some brown butter. And you can kind of like emulsify that all that with either a whisk or in a blender to get like a sort of at least a relatively homogeneous mixture, and then get one of those big injectors and inject it into the meat in various points. And so you can build in a little bit of extra flavor and moisture that way, which I think is kind of pretty essential for a deep fried bird.
Got it. If you're not going to inject it, you wouldn't recommend deep frying a bird.
You can definitely still deep fry, and as long as you brine it or dry brine it for a good amount of time beforehand, you should be pretty safe. And as long as you're also very careful with the temperatures you're cooking it to. So I generally recommend poultry breast meat to around 155 degrees. Personally, I go at 150, which is for some people a little bit too soft. But 155 is like, I think, a very good balance between sort of traditional texture while still maintaining a very high level of juiciness. So once you get up to like the 160, 165 range, you get pretty dry no matter what. No, you don't necessarily need to inject as long as you're careful and you don't let the very center of those breasts come above 155. I think you're pretty safe.
You know, my friend Jeffrey Steingarten once tried to bring a pot to deep fry a turkey on the set of the David Letterman show. And he was really upset when they told him that he couldn't do it, that it was a fire hazard.
I think your friend Jeffrey Steingarten is just he is a living fire hazard.
I see. All right. So Cassandra Gray has a question. We're going to go back and forth. We're not going to maintain strict lane obeyance to courses. So we're going to go back and forth from dessert to turkey. So Cassandra Gray has a question about... she says to Stella that she loves your old-fashioned pie dough recipe and blind bake with sugar trick, and she plans on making a bunch of pies for Thanksgiving. But her problem is that there is so much butter fat that leaks out from the pie and onto the baking sheet that she cooks it on. She says the crust is great, it's crispy after baking the actual pie and even after a stint in the fridge, but the pie plate is a greasy mess, which is pretty, in her own words, inelegant and dangerous, depending on how clumsy you are and whose aunt's tablecloth you are putting the pie plate on. Wow. Cassandra really socks it to us. Stella, what do you say to Cassandra?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm glad that she's asking about it. So a certain amount of buttery residue is only natural for a pie that's made with so much butter. You've got a crust made of butter in a glass dish, transfer is inevitable. So like there's a certain amount that you're just going to have to deal with that one needs to expect. But I do sometimes hear from readers who are experiencing what sounds like a lot of butter escaping the crust, which is not good. And that's not something you should expect or accept from making a pie dough, or specifically making my pie dough. It sounds like a couple of things can be going on that can cause this. The first two, which I think have been pretty widely addressed in the recipe and in the comments and in reader discussion, but is worth mentioning, is that it could be an issue with the flour. It could be the result of using a relatively high protein flour. And the thing about that is that the FDA does not regulate the definition of all-purpose flour. So companies can make whatever blend of soft white wheat or hard red wheat, or combination thereof that they want. It could be 100% of one, 100% of the other, a little of both, whatever. There's no regulated definition of what all-purpose flour is or should be. And so some brands are higher in protein than others, and high-protein flours tend to be lower in starch, and that means the higher protein flours may not be as able to absorb liquid and butter from the crust. So I would first check that you're not using a high protein flour. And a really easy, rough approximate way to do that would be to check the nutrition label and look at the grams of protein per serving. And if it's higher than 3, it's probably too high in protein for this particular recipe. So using a softer flour that has a little bit more starch to handle the butter content of the crust would be a huge help. I use Gold Medal's Blue Label. It's my favorite flour. It's what I use for everything, and that helps a lot. So the first thing I would check is the flour. The second thing I check is the butter. I'm kind of infamous for my deep, abiding love for cheap American-style butter. So if a reader is using a higher fat style of butter, like a European style, that can cause some problems. It's a higher fat butter, so there's more fat than the crust really wants to deal with. So that can be a problem. So switching just to like a basic American, I use my local Kroger brand. I'm not very fancy when it comes to butter, but you can use Land O'Lakes, you know, whatever local brand you're into, just a regular American style butter. So those are the two like ingredient issues I'd take a look at and make sure that you've got the right ingredients for the job. The crust can also leak a little bit of butter if the butter is overworked into the dough, if the pieces are cut too small or smashed too far. For my pie crust, I cut the butter into like approximately half inch chunks, and then I just smash each one a single time. So I think some people have seen Kenji's food processor method and then wondered like, oh, that might be a good way to make Stella's crust. It's a terrible way to make my crust. Like, Kenji's recipe is designed to work under those conditions, and it's brilliant. But if you're like crossing over technique, that's going to overwork the butter, and that can cause the butter to leak out of my crust, or just working it too much by hand. Some people have a pastry cutter, and they may think, oh, I'm going to use this instead. You know, the directions say to smash the cubes, but I'll get similar results. Maybe because so many recipes for pie crust call for pea-sized bits of butter to be cut into the flour, but mine needs to be really chunky, so just make sure you're not overworking the butter pieces. And finally, if the pie dough, you're using the right butter, you're using the right flour, you think you're working the butter to the right amount or as described in the recipe, the final thing that can cause trouble is if your oven is running a little bit hot, or if your oven is running at the correct temperature, but the pie crust is placed a little low in the oven or onto a baking stone. Some recipes will call to use a baking stone, but with my recipe, that kind of like really quick heat transfer just causes the butter to melt out super fast. So it could be something to do with the heat in the oven, whether it's running too hot and that's like melting the butter out of the crust a little too quickly, or whether it's being set on something that's causing a little bit of direct heat transfer and that's causing that to happen too fast. That's the other thing I would look at.
Got it. Now, this has been an ongoing discussion on Serious Eats since Stella came on board and had definite ideas about pie dough. And of course, Kenji is famous for his vodka pie dough. And I think there's room for both.
There's definitely room for both. There's different, I mean, they're different results, different processes. Like for a quick breakdown, I think the end results, Stella's is a sort of more sturdy crust. And it's, I think it's much better, especially if you're doing sort of decorative things. Like, it holds its shape really well. It's nice and sturdy. It's super buttery. Mine is a little bit more sort of tender in the end result. Like, I think it's shorter. It doesn't quite have that kind of crunch that Stella's does. And as far as making it goes, and Stella can tell me if I'm getting any of this wrong or if she disagrees, but as far as making it goes, I think, you know, both of them are quite easy. I think, you know, mine, if you have a food processor, that makes the process really simple. And mine was very specifically designed to be extremely easy to roll out. So when you make the dough, like, it looks, if you've made other pie crusts in the past, when you make my dough, it looks and feels completely wrong, because it basically feels like a ball of Play-Doh, but it's super easy to roll out without cracking. And that was sort of like the big problem I was trying to tackle when designing that recipe. But if you have any kind of experience and you're confident you can roll out a more traditional pie crust, there's no reason to choose mine over Stella's, if that's the result you want.
And it sounds like the key is I think what Stella said, which is don't try to combine these two recipes.
Oh, yes.
This is a 1+1=0.
Yeah, they're very particular because, you know, mine has a very sort of a different technique from most pies, in that it blends the butter really far, and Stella's has sort of the opposite. It's different from most pies in that the butter barely gets blended in at all. So, they're designed to work with the particular ratios of ingredients that we have, and with a particular handling process. So if you do try and combine them, yeah, you end up with something that's
the worst of both worlds.
Yeah. The worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm a huge proponent of, you know, different recipes for different occasions and different recipes for different skill levels and different recipes for different ingredients. So there's definitely room. I mean, I've got two brownie recipes on Serious Eats. I'm not going to begrudge anybody having two pie crusts. Jeez.
So Mike Quimpo has a question that I really want answered and that I think that many city dwellers want answered, which is, With limited oven space, how do you optimize time and appliance use for a full meal menu? I.e., and this obviously applies in this case to Thanksgiving, but it also applies to any meal. Appetizers, main, size, desserts. He's got an Instant Pot, a crock pot, a sous vide immersion circulator, a grill, a stovetop, and an oven. So practically the full range of cooking apparatuses.
Apparati.
But he struggled in getting everything out both timely and warm. How do you begin to prioritize things and stagger cooking times without losing your mind?
So that, yeah, that is a common problem. And it's one that I think starts at the planning phase, at the when you're deciding what dishes you're going to cook. And I think people, especially home cooks, will often think about what they want to eat as opposed to what is possible. And so, yeah, when you have a whole bunch of different pieces of equipment, you know, it doesn't make much sense to make all of your dishes things that come out of the oven, because you know you're gonna, like, even before you start, you know, I'm not going to have the oven space to do all this. So you're shooting yourself in the foot before you even start if you make plans like that. So really, I think your best bet is to plan very carefully and make sure that you have dishes that are coming from, you know, you're using all the sort of available heat sources in your kitchen. So you're utilized, if you have all this piece of equipment, you're utilizing each one of them. Now, like, as far as specifics go, you know, a lot of things can be made ahead. So, you know, if you're talking about appetizers, those are sometimes things that you don't even need to heat up at all. You can make, you know, a really great cheese plate, a really great, like, cheese and charcuterie board, and that requires no cooking, so you're not tying up any of your oven space. You can make some, you know, spiced nuts to have around. So think about things that you can serve at room temperature and make ahead that you don't really have to worry about. And then for things you do want to make ahead, purees, so like mashed potatoes, mashed sweet potatoes, whatever mashed vegetable you want, or gravy, for instance. You know, mashed potatoes are notoriously hard to reheat, because it's partly because their starches kind of retrograde, and so you always have to kind of loosen them up again the second time you're reheating them after the first time you make them. But it's also because they're so thick, it's hard to reheat on the stovetop, because they burn to the bottom of the pan before they heat through, so you kind of have to stir them all the time. They reheat pretty well in the microwave in a bowl if you stir them a lot. They're hard to reheat in the oven. What I generally do for purees is put them in either sous vide or heavy duty Ziploc bags with all the air squeezed out. You can make them ahead even up to a few days there. And if you have a sous vide circulator, you can set a water bath at around 140 degrees or so and put your bag in there. You can do it with the mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes, you can do it with the gravy, and just let them sit there and they'll hold that temperature until you're ready to serve. If you don't have a sous vide machine, you can also just fill a pot with water, heat it up on the stovetop to about 150 degrees, put your bag in there and put a lid on it, and that should stay warm for, you know, at least a couple hours, which gives you a pretty big window to serve them. And then, you know, the turkey, you know, I spatchcock it. It takes about 90 minutes in a 450 degree oven there. You can start, you know, if you have a two rack oven, or if you have multiple ovens especially, but you can start cooking other things while the turkey is in there on a rack below it. And then once the turkey comes out, the turkey still has to rest. So things can finish cooking in there. So if you're roasting vegetables, roasting potatoes or Brussels sprouts or whatever, you can start them in there for the last little bit, you know, just calculate how much time overlap you need. Start them in the oven, then take out the turkey, let them finish off while the turkey's resting, and they'll come out just fine. If you have your crock pot or a slow cooker, most Instant Pots, multi-cookers double as slow cookers these days. Stuffing comes out really well in the slow cooker. It's like one of the few things I think a slow cooker is great at. I think, you know, stuffing in a slow cooker almost has that that texture of stuffing that was cooked inside the turkey, where it's sort of really, really moist and almost sort of like bread pudding like, you know. So stuffing comes out great in a slow cooker. And then, you know, and then remember, you also have your stovetop. So instead of doing your Brussels sprouts in the oven, you can cut them in half, blanch them in salted water the day before until they're, you know, just barely cooked through. Store them in your fridge, and then the next day, when you're ready to serve, you can finish them off on the stovetop. You can use, you know, bacon fat, chorizo fat, just olive oil if you want. Get a nice hot cast iron pan, put all the Brussels sprouts in there face down, and let them really nice sear nice and hard until they're like kind of almost black, and then toss them a bit, and they come out. I mean, I prefer them that way to the oven. Anyway, I'm rambling, but really, I think it's just a question of planning and figuring out what your available heat sources are and making sure you have a good balance. It's the same way a restaurant menu is designed, you know, because on a restaurant line, you have whole bunch of different stations. And so when you're designing a menu, you have to make sure that there's a good balance between different cooking methods so that you're not overwhelming one single cook. So the guy in the fryer doesn't get screwed because every single dish has a fried component. So it's just a question of planning.
So thinking about restaurant lines and maintaining sanity at Thanksgiving, it seems like people sometimes feel compelled to try brand new recipes on Thanksgiving. Stella, sounds like a lot of fun, but wouldn't it be pretty stressful in practice?
It's the famous, like, there's two kinds of people in the world. There's the kind of person who really thrives in a high-pressure environment, who, like, longs to be on a cooking competition show where there's secret ingredients and missing appliances and everything's coming at you. Like, there's a certain kind of person who does really, really well in that environment. And then there's another type of person who is a little bit stressed out by Thanksgiving, and that's the type of person I am personally. I mean, not that I do Thanksgiving because of my angelic mother-in-law taking care of it for me, but like, I find it stressful. You're having to meet a deadline. You're having to, handle a lot of different components, you know, kind of, as Kenji was saying, on different formats. So you've got something in the oven, you got something on the stove, you got something potentially in your pressure cooker or your slow cooker, or you're doing something. Like, there's a lot happening, and you're trying to bring a lot of disparate elements together on a similar timetable. So to me, that's stressful. And with any new recipe, there are always a ton of variables, especially in baking, kind of like we touched on with the pie dough. Aside from just straight up, can you execute the technique correctly on the first try, which is admittedly a big question, especially in the realm of baking, There's all these other variables, like, you know, whether or not you live at altitude, or whether or not your flour is high protein or high starch, or whether you picked up some American or European butter. There's like a million subtle variables that can really influence a recipe. And any single element on its own may not be a big deal. Like, you grabbed the wrong type of flour. Everything else has been pulled off perfectly. It's fine. But when you've got a bunch of small elements stacking together because it's something you've never had a chance to try before, it can really kind of move together to kind of push the recipe off its most desirable path bit by bit, from it's really hot in your kitchen because the oven's going, because you've got a giant vat of mashed potatoes cooking on the stove, because your pressure cooker is, you know, outputting an incredible amount of steam into the air. There's all these things that are happening. Your kitchen's like super hot, and now, you know, your meringue's getting droopy or whatever. So if you haven't tested something before and know what elements to be aware of, it can kind of come back to bite you in the moment. So if you really love being in a high-stress baking environment and just the thrill of pulling something off, go for it. I'm not here to tell you how to, you know, live your best life. But if you do tend to get a little flustered or frustrated by all that's going on and all that you've got to consider on a holiday like Thanksgiving, take the sane approach and, you know, make your familiar family favorites. And if you don't have time to test drive them, you know, a week or so in advance, just don't worry about it. You know, there's still plenty of time to enjoy a nightmarish pecan pie or a brand new method for sweet potato pie or something in December. Right. You don't need to have it like now or die. So I just say, you know, treat yourself kindly. A part of the joy of Thanksgiving is actually enjoying time with your family and enjoying a great meal. So just take the sane approach.
I like this. Kenji, do you take the sane approach?
I am one of these people who strives, who really thrives under pressure. But at Thanksgiving, I do take that approach, but mainly it's not for my sanity. It's because everybody has specific things that they want every year. So we make the same things every year, just because if we didn't, someone would be unhappy.
And I have a question. When did you take over the Thanksgiving meal in your family?
I guess I started taking it over after I started cooking. So I started taking it over like in maybe 2000, maybe around 2000. But in those early days when I was in restaurants, there were a lot of years when I couldn't get home for Thanksgiving because restaurants are usually, well, many restaurants are open on Thanksgiving. I guess it wasn't until after I got out of restaurants and then into magazines. So I guess like around 2007, I think, that I really started doing it every year. Although this year we're having this is the first year, not because of work, we're not having Thanksgiving together. Audrey and I are staying here in California with Alicia, and the rest of my family is going to be in New York. So that'll be a little sad, but
yeah,
it's just the travel schedule just got a little bit too hectic with the toddler because we're doing a ton of trips with her.
So. Got it.
Oh well.
And Stella, even though you don't make Thanksgiving now, there must have been a point before you met John that you were involved in your family's Thanksgiving. Do you even remember that?
You know, I guess I have just always been a Thanksgiving slacker. Before I met John, I was either working in restaurants or bakeries, which involved working on holidays oftentimes. So I kind of like shirked my responsibility there and let other folks take care of it. And then prior to that, I would have been in culinary school. And then prior to that, I would have been in high school. And at that point, I was a real lazy butt. So I'm sure I made dessert. I definitely made dessert. But I wasn't really involved in the meal as a whole. I was very focused on pie, I guess.
Got it. In my family, there's a kind of messy division of labor between my wife and myself. And you both know my wife, who's a wonderful human being, whom I love dearly, and is a really good cook in many ways. But there's...
This means something bad is coming, right?
But there is... We have a hard time sharing the same kitchen. So is that a problem that you two ever encounter, either in your own lives or you've observed in other people's lives?
I encountered it much more in the past than I do now, for a couple of reasons. In the past, I think it was partly because I was, you know, it was at the time of my life when I was still working at restaurants, and I think I hadn't really recalibrated my brain to realize that not every environment is a restaurant kitchen, and that people don't react to other people the same way as restaurant cooks react to each other. And so that was always a problem that I had to sort of retrain myself. Especially given the types of restaurants I'd worked in, which were all sort of very aggressive, loud, angry places.
Hey, Stella, did you ever work in loud, aggressive, angry places?
100%.
It's probably a similar problem to what you have, because I know your kitchen, and by New York standards, it's pretty big, but it's still a kind of narrow space in there. So just the space issue was a big problem in the past when I was living in New York, or at my mom's place in New York, where we had this tiny, tiny kitchen that's essentially a closet, to try and fit multiple people in there was hard. And then you always have like my dad walking back and forth to the fridge like every 10 minutes to refill his Chardonnay or his martini. Or pick at things. So that was frustrating. I think, you know, it was really, for me, it was really an issue of being willing to cede control and also sort of recalibrating and remembering that the food is not really the point of Thanksgiving. And it's that, the family is the point of Thanksgiving. That should be the priority at all times, even when you're cooking. So I think a lot of it is just being able to give up a little control, being okay with things not coming out perfectly, being okay with food being picked at and not arriving at the table the way it should look, etc. It's just about relaxing your perspective on the food.
Yeah, I think you're right.
For me, was the issue.
I think that's what happens to me, because what happens is I start tasting Vicky's dishes. And then I start giving her advice. And somehow that advice is not met with undying gratitude. I think you're right. And I don't think I have that perspective yet. You know, what we've done is we don't occupy the kitchen at the same time.
Well, the thing you have to remember is that it takes what, like 6 hours to cook all the food,
right?
And then probably half an hour to eat it. So Your time is better spent trying to make sure that everybody is happy during those 6 hours than during the half
right.
hour.
Right. That's a great way to think about it. So, Stella, Kathy Bruce has a question about rolls and pie and travel. She says she can make her rolls early on Thursday morning, but she needs to make the pies ahead of time and drive them to North Carolina about 6 to 7 hours. My family is pretty flexible about their pie. I usually make different kinds every year. What kinds of pies travel well or can be heated up successfully? Should she make pie ahead, freeze it, and then bake it on Thanksgiving Day?
Pie is a really good option for make ahead. Ed can attest to the fact that my cherry pie holds up really well to next day treatment.
It's true.
You can fully bake it off and just like, you don't even have to warm it up.
She showed up at our door 24 hours after you made it, and it was awesome.
Yeah, so that's a recipe that crisps up really well on the bottom. Same thing of like my blueberry pie or mixed fruit pie or any of those type of fruit pies that I have on Serious Eats. All of those are really good options for, you know, fully making them in advance and then reheating them on site when you get there if you want to, or just serving them at room temperature. They're all really tasty at room temperature. Same thing for a sweet potato pie or a pumpkin pie or any of those single layer custard pies, pecan pie. All that type of stuff should travel really, really well. Honestly, a lot of these recipes, they do well because of my crust. Because my crust has like a super high proportion of butter in it, it is a little bit almost like moisture repellent because of that nice fat layer. So it helps keep the crust really crispy so you don't have this kind of mushy day-old pie sensation. Although most pies can benefit from just, you know, 5 minutes in a 350 oven just to kind of help re-crisp the crust if it's kind of gone a little soft around the edges or something from some humidity, which is always an issue around the holidays when 1,000 things are cooking on the stovetop. At our house, you know, if we make more than two things and it's like below 20 degrees outside or something, like the windows all immediately fog up in our house. You can just tell how much moisture is in the air. So those pies reheat really well and do really good as make ahead. I think even something like a meringue pie can do pretty well if you are able to carry it in your lap, which admittedly not all people can do when driving. But if you've got like someone you can trust to hold the pie and its carrier, it'll be fine. The problem is if it's a meringue pie and you've got it even in a pie carrier in the back seat, if you break or take a break suddenly or take a sharp turn, it's possible that the pie can have more momentum than the meringue and the meringue can kind of go sailing off. But if somebody is like, not off, but you know, that it can slip, it can become a little bit detached because that like the forces have kind of nudged it out of its like safe resting place. But if you're holding it in your lap in the container, you can kind of be like, okay, we're tilting really hard this way. You can kind of like counterbalance it. So I've transported many a meringue pie with John behind the wheel and just holding it in my lap. And I sometimes post these as videos on Instagram and people are just like losing their minds in the comments and the replies. They're just like, oh my God, you're giving me a stroke. Stop that. But it's fine. It's as long as a competent person is there to hold it in their arms like a baby.
Stella, if you do have like some limited oven access at the destination that you're bringing a pie to, for something like a meringue pie, could you bring the meringue, like bake the pie base separately, bring the meringue separately and kind of construct it and finish it off in the oven there? A quick way to avoid that problem?
That's potentially a good option, presuming you have enough time to cool it back down. Because what happens is with most meringue pies, after they're baked off, even if you've made like the crust and filling and got that all taken care of and assembled in advance, it still needs about 2 hours to refrigerate after that, because that short time in the oven to brown the meringue can kind of do a whammy on the filling and make it a little loose and soft. And so if you've also been traveling, so it's not super cold to start with, that may be problematic. But if you get there in advance, enough that you're able to get them toasted up and then chilled down afterwards, that should be fine.
What about if you made the filling like the base like the day ahead, a day ahead, kept in the fridge overnight and brought it in like a little, you know, kept it cool in like a cooler or something with your other stuff?
Yeah, that would certainly help if you've got the logistics to pull that off, for sure. Sometimes there can be a little bit of volume loss because first of all, I should say that all my meringue pies use a Swiss meringue, which is a meringue that's made by combining the sugar and egg whites together over a water bath. And then I cook them up to a pretty high temperature, 175 degrees. And that ensures that it's fully cooked. The deal is that sugar kind of offsets the coagulation point of the eggs. So if you just cooked it to, you know, whatever temperature, say, Kenji has determined to be like the ultimate egg white cooking temperature for like a poached egg or something, it's not going to behave like that when you're dealing with this much sugar being added to it. So if you're using a different meringue recipe and not my meringue recipe, I don't know that I would recommend traveling with the meringue, because it's going to lose its volume. It doesn't have that kind of stability. But because a Swiss meringue is fully cooked and the way it's whipped and handled, it's very, very stable. And you're going to experience a little bit of volume loss after you make and whip the meringue and then transfer it to a container of some sort, because presumably you're going to need your stand mixer bowl back. You're not going to be able to just like leave it there. Transfer it to another container, cover it, refrigerate it, go somewhere with it. then scrape it back out and arrange it on top of the pie. It's not going to be as fluffy as if you had just made it and put it directly on the pie, but that kind of volume loss is probably also a pretty nice, you know, trade-off for the convenience factor for sure.
This is a question that's also related to making stuff ahead of time. It comes from Debris Hall about roasting a turkey the day before the holiday, either Thanksgiving or Christmas Day, and how do you heat that up? She doesn't know how to do it and have the turkey maintain its moisture. But how can we help Deb here?
It's a difficult problem because so when you're roasting a turkey, you're roasting it until it gets to a specific internal temperature. And so it's hot all the way through. When you're reheating a turkey, assuming it's been chilled in the fridge overnight, when you're reheating a turkey, if the turkey is still roughly the same volume and shape that it was the day before, which it is, unless you've sliced it or something like that, it's going to take just about just as long to reheat it as it did to roast it in the first place, because you still have to wait for that heat to get all the way through to the center. It'll take a little bit less because of sort of evaporative cooling, but it's going to take basically the same amount of time to reheat it. And then you're also going to lose more moisture that way, so your turkey's just not going to end up as good. So really the only solution to this is to somehow break the turkey down in between. So roast the turkey on one day, let it rest a little bit. And the part you're really concerned about is the breast meat, because the legs, you can throw the legs back in the oven whole and they'll crisp up and still be plenty juicy because they're so forgiving. The breast meat, however, is where you're going to run into problems. So I would either slice the breast meat into, you know, maybe quarter or half inch slices, and then reheat them with moisture. So save some of the drippings arrange the turkey breast meat slices in a skillet, an ovenproof skillet, add some of that liquid to the bottom of the pan so it's kind of simmering in there, and reheat it that way. Alternatively, what you could do is you can, if you don't mind this preparation, is you can shred the turkey breast meat. This is an idea I saw actually just a couple days ago from Meathead Goldwyn, who wrote the book Meathead and runs AmazingRibs.com, but he does a smoked turkey breast that he kind of pulls like pulled pork. I'm going to just a disclaimer that I haven't actually tried this, but I've done it with chicken, and I don't see why it wouldn't work with turkey. It would be to roast the turkey whole, and then once the turkey breast is chilled, shred it all and reheat it again in either gravy or in the drippings from the pan. And you could do that directly on the stovetop. But in some form or another, you're going to have to break the turkey down if you want to sort of efficiently reheat it.
Could you reheat it either in gravy or just some chicken stock? Reduce chicken stock?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, even a box of chicken stock. Yeah. And anything that is going to add, you know, be moist so that the turkey breast doesn't dry out so much and sort of evens out the cooking as well. Anything that's moist and you don't want to use like just plain old tap water, because that'll, you know, draw out flavor and not add anything back.
Yeah.
So you do want to use some kind of seasoned, flavorful liquid, and probably not anything too acidic either. So not like you wouldn't want to use like white wine or like vinegar or something
yeah.
like that.
So I have a question for both of you about sweet potatoes and pumpkin. Obviously, there's the age-old debate about using canned pumpkin, which may not even be pumpkin. It could be squash. And fresh pumpkins, depending on if you use the right kind of pumpkin. And the same thing with sweet potatoes. Like, where do you both come out on this canned versus whole and fresh issue when it comes to sweet potatoes and pumpkins? Stella, we'll start with you.
When you think of a pumpkin, we all have this mental image of what would be called a field pumpkin. It looks like a jack-o'-lantern. It's this real big situation, kind of got the classic orange rind and the ribbing and the little curly top of the stem. Like, that's what we all imagine as a pumpkin. A pumpkin is a type of squash, first and foremost. And the companies that make canned pumpkin use a different type of squash than a field pumpkin. So it's not what you envision. And it's not, sometimes some of these companies, like, they'll have a drawing on the front of the label. It's not necessarily a photograph, but like a little stylized pumpkin that looks very much like what you would expect a pumpkin to look like. But that's not necessarily what's in the can.
Right.
An example would be the Dickinson squash, I believe is what Libby's pumpkin uses, which is, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with calling it a pumpkin. There's plenty of wiggle room in terms of what the FDA considers to be a pumpkin, but it doesn't look like what you want a pumpkin to look like. And so I think we have a lot of like romantic imagery tied up around a pumpkin where we think like, oh, I want to make the best pie. I need to use a real pumpkin. And then people go out and buy a real pumpkin, which is terrible for pie. So if you've got a recipe that calls for like pumpkin puree, like don't beat yourself up. Like grab a can of pumpkin puree and just take it easy. Like there's nothing better about buying a pumpkin and roasting it yourself. And let's say, oh, okay, well, I'm going to get a sugar pumpkin because this is a more delicious type of pumpkin and this is what I want to do. Like if that makes you feel good and that's like an enjoyable process for you and that adds to your Thanksgiving experience, like you feel all cozy, like I got some pumpkins in the oven roasting away, like that's fantastic and you should totally go ahead and do that. But if you don't enjoy that process, if you don't feel like, man, this is really like improving my day and my dessert experience, there's not really any huge benefit because the companies that make canned pumpkin are using like the most delicious type of squash product, pumpkin product that they can. They have, you know, scientists and engineers and farmers like all working together to produce like this one like glorious thing. And so like, let them do their job. Like, that's great.
Right.
So that said, when I make a pumpkin pie, I prefer to use a roasted butternut squash as my air quotes pumpkin puree because it has a flavor profile that you're going to read as pumpkin because pumpkin itself doesn't really have much flavor. It doesn't taste like anything. That's why we like load up our pumpkin pies with all these different spices. It just kind of has like this vague earthiness. It's not like a really intense or discernible flavor. And so like kind of one squash can be as good as another. So if I'm going to do it completely from scratch, I'm going to use a butternut squash in part because of the yield. Like it's a real meaty squash. So you can just like split it in half. There's very minimal seeds to scoop out and they're very easy to scoop out. And it's really easy to roast and it's really easy to puree. So that's kind of my take on using a homemade pumpkin pie, homemade mm-hmm. pumpkin puree kind of situation, is I'd rather use butternut squash.
So what about sweet potatoes?
Sweet potato dishes, I've made them with sweet potatoes and I've made them with yams and I find them to be fairly interchangeable, at least in the context of my recipes. And my recipes are all based on taking a fresh sweet potato-like mm-hmm. product and simmering it in milk, poaching it in milk kind of slowly. And so the benefit of this is you not only get like this really nice sweetness out of the sweet potato during the process of poaching it in the milk, you slowly make your own sweetened condensed milk. So you don't have to use canned sweetened condensed milk on the recipe because you're cooking your sweet potatoes and making condensed milk at the same time. So it's kind of like a two-for-one process.
That's why you're a pastry wizard, Stella.
That is genius.
But have you made dishes with canned sweet potatoes that you find okay?
You know, I don't think I've ever even opened a can of sweet potatoes before.
That's good. What about you, Kenji? That's okay. You can admit
I mean,
that.
I should have done it for Kenji, science, but that's something that, like, my dad has often had a garden, and that's, like, a thing he would have grown. Or, you know, John and I have always been big supporters of the farmer's market. So for me, sweet potato access has always been abundant and very easy. So I haven't really had an occasion to do it, although I should have done it for science now, guys. I'm very sorry.
What about you, Kenji? Where are you on this sweet potato and pumpkin divide?
Well, the only time I've ever had canned sweet potatoes was a number of years back when I was at Cook's Illustrated and my buddy Paco, Francisco Robert, he was working on a pumpkin pie recipe. And I think the little trick in that recipe was that it used like two parts canned pumpkin and one part canned yams or canned, you know, whatever, red sweet, orange sweet potatoes. We found in the taste test that we were doing then, we found that most people thought the ones that were made with part sweet potato actually tasted more pumpkin-y, like had a stronger pumpkin flavor than the ones that were 100% pumpkin, because the truth is like pumpkin is pretty bland and sweet potatoes are not. So that's actually something that I do now if I'm making a pumpkin pie. I don't use canned sweet potatoes, but I do use, I'll add some regular sweet potato to it because I think it gives it a sort of better balanced and kind of deeper flavor than just straight up pumpkin. The other trick I do is that Stella mentioned simmering the sweet potatoes. It's a really good method because so sweet potatoes in them have enzymes in them that will convert starches to sugars, and those increase in activity up to a certain temperature point, and then at some point they get killed off and they just stop working completely. Off the top of my head, I think it's around 140 to 145 degrees or so. Their activity kind of increases, and so you're sort of more and more rapidly deliberately sweetening the sweet potato. So whenever I make sweet potatoes, pretty much whatever I'm going to do with them, I try and cook them as slowly as possible so that they spend a lot of time under that temperature range. So if you're roasting them, that means roasting them at a very low temperature, you know, 300 or lower. Or if you're going to make mashed sweet potatoes or use them in a pie filling like that, you know, Stella's method of doing it in the milk, that would definitely... Because boiling is a simmering is a relatively gentle method, that would definitely help sweeten them up. That would be my advice is slow cook the sweet potatoes. And then even if you're making a pumpkin pie, consider adding a little bit of slow cooked sweet potato to the filling because I think it improves the flavor.
So where are you both on the yams versus sweet potatoes? Are they interchangeable? Should people see them as interchangeable? Should they worry if the recipe calls for yams and you get sweet potatoes or vice versa?
Well, yams aren't yams technically, but what we call yams in the U.S. are a type of sweet potato. So it's not really one or the other. It's just a question of nomenclature. At least that's my understanding. Maybe Stella can confirm or deny that.
That's been my understanding as well, although I admit that I have not deeply researched the subject.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I wrote about it in my book, and I'm pretty positive that what I wrote in my book is correct. So if what I just said now matches up with what's in my book, then I stand by it.
I'm pretty sure everything I know about it came from Kinji, so.
Sometimes that's true about both of you, actually. So, Stella, you've also been an advocate for making cakes instead of pies around the holidays. Is that just a personal preference, or do you think there's a good reason for it?
A little bit personal preference, just because I'm a team cake kind of girl. I mean, I'll say that I don't really believe in the dichotomy of team cake versus team pie. There's room in this world for both. But, you know, if push comes to shove, I really want cake. So I'm pro cake. I love cake. I don't know that it's really like the best choice from a purely like pastry chef kind of perspective, because, you know, Thanksgiving is a pretty rich and heavy meal. And you get to the end of it and like a cake slathered in buttercream is not exactly like the counterpoint to that. It's just kind of like a more is more, like just piling it on. But that's kind of what I want out of my Thanksgiving experience. So I'm totally okay with that. You know, a layer cake with frosting is definitely a little bit of a richer option than, you know, even an apple pie a la mode or something. But that's okay. I really like cake, so...
Kenji, you know, which team are you on? We now know that Stella is definitively on the cake team.
I'm firmly on the pie side. For me, I just prefer desserts that are more, I guess, fruit based than like sort of chocolate or cake. I don't know why. I guess I just feel a sort of more direct connection to things that grow on trees that I can pluck and bite into, as opposed to things made from sort of more refined ingredients, which is, you know, I don't mean to crap on cakes and cookies and chocolate, but I guess I feel closer to pies and tarts than I do to cakes.
We should also pause to note that Kinji lives in California and has fruit trees. Like in Kentucky, I've got nothing, you guys.
That's true. You have fruit trees in your backyard.
But I've held this view long before living in California. Actually, just before this call, I was eating guavas off of our tree, and just outside my back, there's a guava tree like 6 feet away from me, and I was eating them just before this call.
I rest my case, Your Honor.
Yeah, I think Stella may have a point, but you know, Kenji did spend a lot of years on the East Coast, where there really were seasons. I have a question about turkey. Should people be slaves to turkey? You know, there's a lot of people who don't really care for turkey, but it seems like people feel obligated to make turkey.
Ed, so first of all, I love turkey. It's my favorite poultry. Tied with maybe like some certain duck preparations, but I love turkey, and I particularly love turkey breast. And this, you know, this wasn't always the case. So I'm going to say something that your friend Jeffrey Steingarten once said to me when I made a ignorant comment about coffee, which is that if someone says they don't like turkey, they're speaking exactly like someone who knows nothing about turkey.
I was there when he said that to you. We were sitting at Motorino, the pizzeria.
Yeah. No, so honestly, I think the reason people don't like turkey is the same reason that people maybe in my generation or earlier didn't like a lot of vegetables like Brussels sprouts, and it was because they were always overcooked. And I think that's a lot of the reason why people don't like turkey. It is an extremely unforgiving meat to cook, because that breast meat, you know, even more difficult than chicken. You know, chickens have the advantage of being relatively small, so that even when you kind of screw them up, they at least cook relatively evenly through and through. Turkey breast, it's really difficult because it's this big fat thing that you're trying to cook evenly, and you're trying not to overcook. And on top of that, you know, you have this problem where if you cook the entire turkey as a whole bird, the legs don't cook fast enough, so you almost always end up overcooking the breast meat. And so really, I think what people don't like is overcooked turkey breast meat. But when it's properly cooked, it can be, you know, when you properly dry brine it and when you don't overcook it, it's super juicy. You know, nobody would ever say that it's more flavorful than like a turkey thigh or a duck thigh. But, you know, there's a lot of people have this view that like more flavor is always better. And I think subtlety is also important. Like there's a lot of super subtle dishes and a lot of cuisines that really celebrate subtlety. And so, you know, as long as you don't think of the turkey breast as bland, just think of it as subtle and really pay attention to the flavors that are in there because it does have flavor. They're just subtle flavors.
I love that. And when you spatchcock the turkey and you're flattening it, and that sort of in part solves the cooking different parts of the bird.
Not just in part, it completely solves it. I don't know how much more I can talk about spatchcocking, but I've been advocating it for years now, and I still how I do it every year. I haven't found a method that works better, or more easily, or faster.
Yeah, I'm a devotee. Stella, do you share Kenji's passion for turkey breast?
I really love turkey. I love all parts of the turkey. I think I'm more of a turkey leg kind of girl, but I kind of like Kenji that I think that it does have a subtle flavor, and I get a lot of big flavors in my day-to-day life, like just like intensity. And so I enjoy just like having something like delicate to savor. I think delicacy is kind of an underrated value in food these days. And I also am really fortunate to live within a few miles of a farm that produces heritage turkey breeds. And so I can, at Thanksgiving, we don't do it for Thanksgiving per se, because like I said, my mother-in-law has got the lockdown on Thanksgiving, but my husband and I tend to order a heritage turkey from Elmwood Stock Farm here in Kentucky every year that we usually, John and I have a secret holiday for ourselves that we invented. So we make a heritage turkey for that. And that's really nice.
And, you know, Kenji, this is something that you and I have discussed on the air before. People are always asking, do they have to get a heritage turkey? You know, and our basic point of view has always been, right, that it's whatever the turkey you can afford. If you can avoid frozen processed turkeys, you should. But after that, you're kind of on your own.
Yeah. I mean, from a flavor perspective, there's no doubt that most heritage breed turkeys are going to give you more flavor than the commercial turkeys that have been bred more for size and consistency than for actual flavor. So if flavor is what you want, you definitely want to get a heritage turkey. You know, price is going to be a big consideration, but what you're getting for the price is A, more flavor. Generally, you're going to be supporting smaller farmers, and you're going to be supporting animals that are treated better. The one thing to watch out for, no matter what kind of turkey you get, is that you want to make sure, you want to know whether your turkey has been pre-brined or not. So most commercial turkeys, like your Jennie-O's and your Butterballs, those have been injected with a brine solution, and you'll see a little label on the package that'll say enhanced with up to a 10% brine solution, something like that on the packaging. And if you have one of those turkeys, then you don't want to brine it yourself, and you don't want to either dry brine it or regular brine it yourself, because it'll end up too salty. Generally, I recommend buying natural turkeys, so turkeys that have been slaughtered, minimally processed, no other ingredients added, no brine added, because that gives you a lot more control over the end result. So you can brine it the way you want to, you can treat it the way you want to, and you just have a little bit more control. But yeah, generally, I would personally look for a reasonably priced heritage turkey, preferably from a local farm, but you know, not everybody has the access to that or the money for it. So you can definitely get good results out of any turkey. It's just a question of, you know, how you value your money and what other things you value.
Well, you know, Kenji, you and I, we talk about spatchcocking all the time, and we should remind our listeners that we have everything you need to know re-spatchcocking on Sirius Eats. We have videos, and also we have everything you need to know about pie baking on Sirius Eats. So you should just use this podcast as a jumping off point to get to the site where we really do have all the answers to making your Thanksgiving less stressful. Written by our guests. How about that? Like, we didn't even have to steal the content. So I have a question. This is something I also argue with Vicky about. It's like, I don't feel that you need to put out appetizers before Thanksgiving. Like, Thanksgiving's kind of a big, overwhelming meal. So maybe if you want to put out some crudité, but I think if you put out cheese or charcuterie, as Kenji mentioned, aren't people just going to get full? Like, shouldn't we try to minimize the number of things we serve with drinks?
Well, I think one thing to consider is that the snacks are things that will lure people out of your way. So I don't do Thanksgiving, but I've done dinner parties. Yes. And man, a well-placed like snack assortment can really free up some kitchen space.
I love that.
Snack traps.
What about you?
No, I mean, for me, it is kind of the same. Whether it's a dinner party or a big holiday, I think the appetizers are really more a way to make sure that the guests are happy and don't come into the kitchen and start poking at things while you're, while you're under stress. I mean, although it inevitably happens anyway, but I think of like the charcuterie platter as like my surrogate in the dining room. It's like the surrogate host for the house. Because it shows people, I'm thinking about you, I care, but I'm not going to come talk to you right now.
So it sounds like Stella and Kenji, you guys are in the same camp as to the function of things that you put out with drinks.
When introverts cook.
They're a diversion. they're ways to divert people's attention and to literally divert them from walking into the kitchen.
And stealing all the items.
Yeah, I mean, it's again like a thing from restaurants. Like you design your menus so that there are certain things that people can order that will come to the table immediately and with very little fuss from the kitchen, so that they have something in front of them and feel happy and comfortable while you prepare the rest of their stuff. You know, that's yeah. Kind of the point of hors d'oeuvres and appetizers on a restaurant menu. I mean, it's partly because that's a nice way to have a meal, but it's really just to make it easier for the kitchen to sort of manage the flow of food and manage the expectations of guests.
We do have one final thought we want to get on the table, no pun intended, or maybe there's a pun intended there. Cranberries, whole or smushed?
Popped.
Well, I mean, I kind of just put them in the pot with the sugar and a little bit of whatever liquid I'm using and let them cook. And, you know, I stir them with a spoon and then some of them get smushed and some of them stay a little chunkier, but they all kind of pop as they cook, you know?
They're self-smushing.
They're self-smushing.
Yeah.
It's like, they're self-basting. Cranberries are self-smushing.
Yeah. You cook them and just let nature take its course.
That's the perfect final thought. Thank you both, Kenji, Stella. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And I'd also like to thank the Sirius Eats community for sending us their questions. I hope we have succeeded in reducing your Thanksgiving-related stress. And we're also thankful here at Special Sauce for everyone who helps make the podcast a joy to create. Our producer, Marty Goldenson, our new associate producer, Grace Chen. Welcome to Special Sauce, Grace, and everyone here at Radio Arts and our other studio, CDM. So happy Thanksgiving, everyone, to you too, Kenji and Stella. May your turkey day be filled with lots of seriously delicious food and drink and the sound of friends and family enjoying each other's company. And if you want to ask some holiday questions for an upcoming holiday call Special Sauce, send them to specialsauce@SiriusEats.com. Thank you both. That was awesome.
Yay.
Thank you.
So long, Sirius Eaters. We'll see you next time.